Let's see, I'd like to first ensure that we have all silenced our cell phones, and I'd like to ask you to please help me welcome Leslie Kay from Modesto.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Leslie Kay. I am an alcoholic. And it is an honor to be here tonight. Thank you. Nate, where did Nate go? Nate asked me to do this over a year ago, so I've had one full year to think about this. Which isn't true. I said yes, put it on my calendar, and immediately put it out of my mind. And didn't start thinking about it until like 2 weeks ago. So it all works out perfectly. And I want to thank Lee for recommending me to Nate, and Cora for running such a great meeting. Congratulations to everybody who picked up chips tonight, especially our newcomers. Welcome. I hope you find in Alcoholics Anonymous what I have found in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I have found, oh, and hi to everybody on Zoom. Hello, Zoom people. So, you know, what I have found in Alcoholics Anonymous is magic, is the magic. Especially for someone like me. My sobriety date is May 4th, 1992, which means that my last AA birthday, I celebrated 31 years of continuous sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there are two things about that which are absolutely amazing. The first is that I have been sober longer than I drank. And that's amazing. I never thought I would get to say something like that. I've been sober longer than I drank. Now, there's some bad news that goes along with that, and that is that I have been sober longer than I drank, which means that every dumb thing I've done in the last 31 years, I cannot blame on being drunk. I was stone cold sober when I made those dumb decisions, stone cold sober when I took those dumb actions, stone cold sober when I learned those very difficult lessons. I have a sister in this program, a sister of the heart. And she always tells people that are new in the program, she says, I hope you have an airbag and you buckle up because this is going to be a ride of your life. And it's true. It's true. You know, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous not really understanding why I was here. Now, if you had spoken to anybody else that knew me, they could have told you why I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I really didn't know why I was here. I had a vague idea it had something to do with the fact that I had been caught drunk one too many times. And that really was how I looked at it. They caught me again. They know now the gig's up again. And so I walked into the back doors of the Concord Fellowship and up in the Bay Area, and it was around, I don't know, 1989, 1990. I'm not exactly sure when. I will tell you that there were Christmas decorations on the table, but that doesn't mean anything. It's the Concord Fellowship, so it could have been July, you know. Yeah. I weighed 300 pounds. I sweated vodka. My hair was several different colors, on purpose, but because I was trying to dye my hair, and when you have that much alcohol in your system, dye does funny things to it. And I was about to lose my job, which is really weird because I was a civil servant. And do you know how difficult it is to get fired as a civil servant? And I was this close to losing my civil service job. And so I came into Alcoholics Anonymous basically just hoping that would sort of take the pressure off, that somehow people that kept catching me doing things that I shouldn't have been doing would see that, you know, I thought maybe they were right, and see, look, I'm trying to do something, and so they'll back off. They'll just back off. And I walked in here with a terrible, terrible tale of woe. I mean, a serious, serious sad story. And there was a part of me that almost hoped that when I told you my story, that your reaction would be, you know, Leslie, we recommend that nobody here drinks. But in your case, we feel so sad for you that, you know. It's okay. And I will also tell you that I tried to do what I thought I heard in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is what I thought was the program. And I'm not going to tell you that this was everything everybody was saying. I'm just going to tell you that this is what I heard. And here's what I heard. Put the plug in the jug. Go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Don't drink between meetings, and you'll be fine. And that's what I kept trying to do. And I did it again and again and again. I would put that plug in the jug. I'd start going to meetings. Look at me, I'm going to meetings. Meetings every day, 2-3 times a day. Here I go, one more meeting. And sometimes I could get 5, maybe 10 whole days of continuous sobriety. And then something would happen, and I would just get struck drunk. And I didn't plan on it. I didn't mean to. It wasn't like I woke up that morning and said, heck with them, I'm going to drink today. I remember having a sober blackout at one point. Seriously, a sober blackout. I'd be sitting in the front room and thinking to myself, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to be okay. I haven't had a drink. It's been, 15 days? I haven't had a drink for 15 days. I'm going to be fine. I'm going to be fine. I'm going to go to that meeting tonight and everything will be fine. And then something happened, and my next conscious memory of that particular night is that I was down at Zealfredo's, which was a little Italian restaurant down the street from my mother's house, and I was at the bar, and I was on my second shot of JD. And the only reason I knew it was the second shot is because I'm an old bar drinker. I wasn't a bar drinker at the end of my drinking, but at the beginning of my drinking, I was a bar drinker. And I learned real fast in California. Now apparently they don't do this anywhere else. I found that out. But in California, you walk into a bar, you order your drink, you pay for it. The bartender brings you back your money. The money stays on the bar. And you just keep ordering. And the bartender just takes the money until it's gone, and you throw more money on the bar. And if you're a woman, you should never have to do that more than once. And if you do, you go to another bar. Everybody knows that. And I remember that particular night as the whiskey rose to my head, as it says in the big book. I remember thinking, well, I'll just keep going back. I'll just go back. And that was really the only thing I did right at the beginning of my journey into Alcoholics Anonymous. I just kept coming back because I didn't know what else to do, right? I did kind of get the idea at one point that it was probably the Concord Fellowship's fault. So I started going to other meetings, and I would go to meetings in Walnut Creek, and I'd go to other meetings in Concord, meetings in Pleasant Hill, meetings down in Danville. I'd go to meetings all over the place. And I swear I kept hearing the same message over and over again. Put the plug in the jug. Go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Don't drink between meetings, and you'll be fine. And so I thought, I'm just a massive failure in Alcoholics Anonymous. One more thing I'm a massive failure at. Whatever. But you know, the people around me were like, they were like cheering me on, at least she's trying, you know, kind of thing. And I walked into a meeting one day, finally, and it was a meeting at a place called the Concord Originals. And I walked, let me tell you how I was going to meetings. And this might give you an idea of why I was having some problems. The meeting, this particular meeting started at 7 o'clock. So I would walk into the doors at about 6:59, right? And I would look around the rooms and I would try to sit in the back, where, you know, as underneath the paint in the back of the room. And I couldn't get back there far enough. That day there was no place to sit but in front of this guy, this mean old alcoholic man. You know the kind. They have been sober for 300-400 years. They sit in the meetings, get a book, get a sponsor. You know those people, right? And there was this guy in the meeting that everybody loved. His name was Fast Eddie, because everybody had nicknames back there. Fast Eddie. And he was about this tall, and he wore a little walking cap like he was from Ireland, and he was from New York originally, so he had that cute little accent. And if Eddie said the sky was blue, people lost their minds. Oh my God, did you hear that? Eddie said the sky is blue. That's just so spiritual. I didn't like him. But there was no place to sit but opposite Eddie. So I sat down. And they did what we did tonight. They said, is there anybody here in their first 30 days of continuous sobriety? And I raised my hand one more time. I'm Leslie. And I'm back. And I waited for you all to go, oh, boogie, boogie, I'm so glad you're here. You boogie, boogie, boogie. And before you could do that, Eddie yelled at me. Now, I have since been in other meetings with people who were also at that meeting, and they have pointed out to me that Eddie was dying of emphysema and was on oxygen, and he couldn't yell, but I remember yelling, he's dead, and this is my story. So here's what happened. He yelled at me. He looked me straight in the eye and said, aren't you goddamn tired of always saying you're in your first 30 days of sobriety? I'm goddamn tired of listening to you say it. And what popped out of my mind was the only thing I had learned in the 2 years I'd been running around Alcoholics Anonymous. You're supposed to love me until I can love myself. And he said, I don't love you. He said, I don't even like you very much. He says, you have been coming in here for 2 years. Wine, wine, wine. He says, you whine about your dead husband. You whine about your dead baby. You whine about your parents getting divorced when you were six. He says, when are you going to come in here and say, I want to quit drinking and I can't. Somebody help me. So, you know... So I have to tell you something about myself. I was raised primarily by my mother's family in Northern California. We are first generation Americans. They are right off the boat from Italy. In fact, when my mother passed away, she was the last living relative that spoke Italian in the family. And so English was a second language for us. We were very immigrant kind of, values, you know, you pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Education is very important. Don't shame the family. Do what you're supposed to do. Be good, blah, blah, blah. Be American, for God's sakes. That was like all drummed into our heads all the time. And so I've always primarily identified as a nice Italian girl from Northern California. My mother married this tall, about 6'5", Irish Texas guy, right? Jet black hair. Looked like a cross between Errol Flynn and John Wayne. And if you're too young to know who that is, Google it, because I don't have time. Very handsome man, but very much a man of his culture, right? World War II combat vet, Texas, West Texas, tough guy, Irish, and hair trigger. Violent, amoral, rah, kind of guy. The guy you want on your side during a fight. Let me just put it that way. And when Eddie yelled at me, that entire lifetime of identifying with these happy-go-lucky Latin types that, you know, just love you with pasta and have a great time, went right out the window. And 10,000 years of Irish ancestry just sort of rose up out of nowhere. And I spent the next about 60 days going to every meeting I could find him at and just staying sober right at that SOB. I would just sit down... I would go to a meeting, there you are. And I just did that at every meeting. I was so angry. I was so angry that time started going by and I didn't even realize it. And pretty soon I was getting chips. It's 30 days, come get your chip. And I'd go up and I'd grab the chip. And I'd run back and I'd show it to Eddie. I'd go, look at me, I got a chip. He'd say, you know, we give those to anybody. God. So what happened for me was that I got physically sober. I got sober. Pretty soon I had 60 full days of continuous sobriety. And I was as sober as I was ever going to get. I was as sober at 60 days as I am right now at 31 years. I could not get any more physically sober. I was sober. And you guys had lied to me because nothing was fine, okay? Stoplights were taking forever to change. Colors were way too bright. things were just, people were talking all the time in your face, and they'd go to meetings in these bright little AA smiles and their bright little AA eyes, and everybody would be all the time, give and let live, one day at a time, get a book, la ha ha, you know, all this stuff going on all the time. Do you know if you have a dog, it has to be fed every single day? I mean, it was just that, and I wanted to die. I wanted to die. And it was the first time I had ever wanted to kill myself. I was 60 days sober, and I wanted to die. But I wanted more than that. I wanted some of you to die. And I knew who you were, and I knew where you went to meetings. And so I had a plan. And my plan was to take my 1987 Chevy Impala and drive it right up the front stairs of the Concord Fellowship, into the fellowship, and just take out as many of you as I could. And that was my plan. And you are laughing, but I'm going to tell you something. About 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks after this particular night, I am standing inside the Concord Fellowship, and by that time I have a sponsor, and I'm following directions. And my sponsor yells, "Leslie, move!" And I move, and some woman's car came right through the wall. And everybody went, "Oh!" And I just went and got her coffee. "Come on in, honey. You go sit right next to me. You are my new best friend. I know exactly what's going on with you." But for whatever reason, I couldn't turn the corner fast enough. And so I just walked in. And God saw fit to put my very first AA sponsor into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that night. And it was a guy we used to call, his nickname was Cajun Kenny. And Kenny had sobered up in the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola, and he was not very impressed with the sorority girl gone bad, right? And so he was the only one that walked up to me and said, "What is wrong with you?" And I told him, "I can't take this anymore. I haven't had a drink for about 60 days. I got this stupid chip that Manny hates me. I like these meetings. I tried to read the book in the meetings. He says that you people are always yelling at me that I don't anything." He was like, "Whoa, come with me." And he took me outside, and he rummaged around in his truck, and he handed me a tape. "Yes, young ones, we used to listen to people on little cassette tapes." And he handed me this tape, and he said, "I want you to go home, and I want you to listen to this man. He says, this is a tape of my sponsor. And if you still feel like killing people after you have heard this tape, then I want you to call me, because there are people at this fellowship I don't like. And I will help you." You know, very recently, I was asked to share somewhere, and I shared that part of my story, which hasn't changed in over 31 years. That is the truth of how I met my first sponsor. And afterwards, when people were coming up and thanking the speaker like they do, this little girl who, I'm not kidding you, she had a big book and a Psych 101 book right underneath the big book. And she was there, it was an open speaker meeting, and she was there because she was observing. She was there as a grad student in psychology. No, it couldn't have been, must have been undergrad, because it said Psych 101. And she's standing there and she says, that was such a wonderful story. Do you know what he was doing? Do you know what he was doing? He was doing what they tell us to do as therapists. They tell us to meet the patient where they're at, to just meet them where they stand. And I looked at her and I said, he had done 10 years in the Angola State Penitentiary. I'm pretty sure he really didn't like some of the people at the Concord Fellowship. I don't know, we could call him now, but she wasn't convinced. I'm telling you to this day, he won't tell me. When I talk to him, he says, let's just let it stay out the way I said it. But what I heard sounded reasonable to me. And so I agreed to that. I told him I wouldn't take any other action until I heard that tape. And I went home that night. And that is when the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous happened for me. Because it was on that tape that I heard the magic of AA. And it's real important that I tell you this part because I want everybody in the room to hear it. The person I heard the magic from, the person that turned on the light for me, is someone I have nothing in common with. Absolutely nothing. Different gender, different age group, different socioeconomic past, different faith tradition. Everything about this person was absolutely different from me. But what I heard him say was that every single time somebody told him he had a problem with drugs and alcohol, what they usually didn't realize is that he was stone cold sober when they were giving him that information. And he always wanted to grab them and say, "Don't you get it? My problem is not drugs and alcohol. My problem is I don't have any drugs and alcohol right now." And that's when the light went on. See, I am very much a late bloomer when it comes to drinking. I did not have my first drink until I was 17 years old, which means that I had 17 years of continuous sobriety before I ever picked up a drink. And let me tell you what those 17 years were like. And what I'm going to tell you is what I felt like during those 17 years. I can't ever really tell you that that's exactly what was going on, but I can tell you that this is what it felt like. It felt like a life that was run on 1,000 different forms of fear. I have a friend back east, and she talks about feeling like she would walk around with her shoulders up around her ears. And that's what it felt like for me. It felt like I was constantly trying to prove something to the rest of you, that I belonged here, that I had a right to where I was sitting or standing, and a right to be breathing the same air as the rest of you. You all looked so much better than me. You were prettier than me. You were smarter than me. You had the right size of the body. Your hair was the right color. You knew how to talk to people. The jokes you told were funny. They were never inappropriate. I told nothing but inappropriate jokes, and I never meant to. Let me give you an example. I was blessed with 12 years, was given 12 years of a Catholic education. Now, I'm not recovering from that. I loved my 12 years of Catholic school. I'm a practicing Catholic today. If that upsets anybody, you need to do a fourth step and talk to your sponsor. For me, it is the way I express my spirituality, and I love every bit of it. But when we were in about second grade, we were given an assignment to go home and to have come up with a family motto. And so the next day, we're all there, these lovely little second graders, right? And kids were getting up one at a time, standing in the front of the room, and Monsignor Wade was there to hear us all. He's in the back, and Sister Mary Frances is there calling us up one by one. And the first one gets up, "The family that prays together stays together." Oh, that's so beautiful, thank you, blah, blah, blah. "We are a family united under the mantle of Our Lady, Queen of Peace." Oh my God, you're all so beautiful. That's wonderful. Blah, blah, blah. And then it comes to me. And I go, "The Shaws may go down, but if they go down, they go down with all guns firing." Which is what my father told me our motto was. And so the poor nun is about to have a heart attack, and Monsignor Wade, who was from Ireland, knew my dad and loved him, is like this. But people like called the principal because their kids went home and said, you know what Leslie said? Here's what Leslie said. And so, you know, that was my life, right? Nothing I ever did was right. My grades were not good enough. I know I didn't have the right kind of friends. I know I didn't have any friends. This is how I felt all the time. I knew that if you found out about me, you would make me leave. That's what I knew. I knew that if you found out, you'd make me leave. Now, here's what, if you would ask that question, what was Leslie like growing up? Here's what my mother would have said. Oh my God, she had nothing but kids around her all the time. The phone was always ringing. We had kids running in and out of this house constantly. She was the lead in all the plays. She got nothing but straight A's. She was National Honor Society. She was California State Federation. She flew up the ladder in Campfire Girls. She was the little star. Now, how do you reconcile those two things? I'll tell you how. 17 years of seeing everything through this veil of fear. Just fear. And I don't know why I had the fear. I don't know if I got dropped on my head when I was born. I have no idea. All I know is that I was run by that. And then when I was 17 years old, two of the cool girls at Carondelet High School invited me to off-campus lunch. And I thought, I've arrived. And there we go, and we get into my little Gremlin X, 1974 Gremlin X, periwinkle blues, fake mag wheels and a racing stripe on the side. I'm telling you, baby, I was styling. And we drove down to the neighborhood park, and one of those girls pulled out a bottle of Southern Comfort. And every bone in my body wanted to go, no, put that away. We're underage. We are going to get in trouble. That is a sin. We're going to get in so much trouble. And instead, when it got to me, I went, oh, okay. Because what's more important? Your entire moral compass? Or the fact that two cool girls asked you to go off campus lunch? Come on. I think it's a fairly simple decision to make, don't you? All the moral compass went right out the window. I take a slug. That stuff tasted so horrible. But it went down my throat, and it hit my stomach, and it went, and my shoulders came off my ears. And all of a sudden, I could take a deep breath. And I had no idea that what that was an abnormal reaction to alcohol. I didn't know that what had happened to me in that instant only happens to about 9, maybe 10% of the population, depending on which study you read. I also didn't know that a switch was flipped. The switch that said when that bottle came around again, I wasn't going to go, oh, no, thanks. I'm fine now. My shoulders are off my ears. I can take a deep breath. I'm good. No. I got to take another one. It goes around, and pretty soon, I have finished that bottle, and they're wondering where their part went. And I am feeling better than I've felt ever. And we're driving back, and we drove backwards through Jack in the Box to make our order, and I thought that was great. And then we got back, and we had to go to French class, and I spoke French fluently that day, and nobody died, nobody got arrested, and everything was fine, and why wouldn't I do that again as soon as possible? Come on. Now listen, I'm also a child of the 70s and the 80s. And the good news about the 70s, 80s are two things. Number one, there was no internet. And number two, cocaine was not addictive back then. No, it wasn't. They did it. They did studies. People read papers. And while I will never introduce myself as I'm an alcoholic and an addict, because to me that's like saying, hi, I'm a Chevrolet in a car. It makes no sense. What I will tell you is that when I was out partying, and I'm having a few drinks, if somebody put something in front of me, I never said, well, what will that do? Instead, I would just go, okay, let's try it. And whatever. And then I just sorted everything out, right? And it wasn't until I did my first, fourth, and fifth step that I realized that everything I did, besides alcohol, mimicked that reaction to alcohol. So I didn't like the stuff that you smoked and your head goes to the table and you're out for 3 hours. Who needs that? I want to be in the mix of things, baby. I want to be on, you know, I want to know what's going on. And you know what? I'm also never going to tell you that the reason I came to AA is because alcohol stopped working. It never stopped working. Never. And the one thing I do know is that it would work today. I know it would. Because that's the whole thing about being an alcoholic. See, I think one of the biggest, and this is an opinion, I think one of the biggest disservices we do to newcomers in this program is we say things like, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is found in the first 164 pages of the Big Book. And I think that that's a disservice because we miss the doctor's opinion. Because it's in the doctor's opinion that I found myself. And you know what? If you are a newcomer in AA, and we take you to the doctor's opinion, and you do not find yourself in the doctor's opinion, the good news is you might not be an alcoholic. And that really is good news. Alcoholics Anonymous is the only place where if somebody says, you know what, I don't think I'm an alcoholic, we all go, oh. That's good news. If someone says, you know, I've read the doctor's opinion, I think my problem is I'm a bit of a hard drinker. You guys have given me a lot to think about, and I'm gonna cut that. Yay, go forth and have a good life. Because if you're not an alcoholic of my type, of the kind found in the doctor's opinion, all you're gonna find here is confusion and misery. I believe that. Yes, it's an opinion, but I believe that. And the reason I believe that is because I have watched people over the last 3 decades try to convince themselves that they belong here when maybe really they don't. But they don't like those other programs. You know, there's not enough sobriety in those other programs. I just changed what it said in the big book and put it to what, you know, what I could use. Fantastic. But the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is designed for people like me, and I presume for the majority of people like you, except for the people that were brave enough to say, I'm a member of Al-Anon, bless your hearts. God, I love you people. And I'll tell you why. Because we have this program in AA, and if you are somebody who, when you are stone cold sober, you are restless, irritable, and discontent. And I will add to that, when it's just me, just Leslie, and I am sober, I start off restless, irritable, and discontent. And then I start getting a little angry. And then I start getting a little sad. And then I start getting a little scared. And then I start getting a little paranoid. And pretty soon you all suck. And it's all your fault, and blah, blah, and this and that, and it's all going in my head again. And what I know today, just like I knew on May 3rd, 1992, is that if that gets out of control, if I have one drink, my shoulders will come off my ears, and I'll be able to take a deep breath. And I know that today. I know that. From the top of my pointed little head to the bottom of my flat little feet, I know that. I am fully convinced to my innermost self that I am an alcoholic. I'm not just a hard drinker. I'm not just someone that's had a couple of bad days. I'm not just someone that maybe went to a DUI school and they said, go check out AA.
Okay.
That's not me. I'm the person that the 12 steps were designed for. Because guess what the 12 steps are designed to do? The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are designed for people like me, that if you take each one of those steps one at a time, and you apply the principles and take the actions that each step asks you to apply and take, and you do that, what will happen is that you will have a spiritual awakening. Now, in my case, that spiritual awakening reintroduced me to the God of my understanding. And those steps allow me to develop a relationship with that God that is so personal and so powerful that no matter what happens out here in the world, my shoulders stay exactly where they are. And I don't have to drink and I don't have to use one day at a time, no matter what is going on. That's what it means to join the No Matter What Club, is to be that convinced, is to have that experience with the 12 traditions. And I have been blessed enough, today I have a sponsor that is what we call a three legacy sponsor. My sponsor knows where I am tonight. I know where my sponsor is. My sponsor knows what I look like. My sponsor knows what I sound like. I have a relationship with my sponsor today. I am sponsored today. And that sponsor has taught me that not only are the 12 steps absolutely necessary for me to be able to not drink no matter what, I've got to learn the other two legacies of this program. And they are found in the 12 traditions and the 12 concepts of Alcoholics Anonymous. The 12 traditions, that not only show us how we can function inside of Alcoholics Anonymous, but there are principles behind each one of those traditions. And if I take those principles into my life and I start acting upon those principles, I can have relationships outside the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can do what I call go outside and pass for normal out there. Because I don't know about you, but there are definitely an us and a them. And listen, I love them. There were a lot of them in my life when I got here, and they loved me. But if you ever listened to them, there's something wrong with them. Seriously. Something bad happens in their life, right? And if you say something to them like, let me go get you a drink, they say weird things like, why? What good will that do? What? I'm sorry. Again, I know what good it'll do. I know exactly what good it will do. But they don't have the same reaction to alcohol that I have. And I think that one of the things that confuses me and confused a lot of people, especially when I got here, you know, if anybody drinks enough alcohol, they'll get drunk. But it's the alcoholic that has that complete and total psychic change when they drink. Where their shoulders come off their ears, they can take a deep breath, where they can walk into the same room that scared the heck out of them just minutes ago, and they have a couple of drinks and they're walking into that room like they own the place, because they do. They're the best. That was my dad. You know, I was raised by my mother and my mother's family, but my father was my first love. The dad always is for a little girl, just the way it is. Nothing wrong with that, just the way it is. And my father, like I said, he was a World War II combat vet, had been raised up in West Texas during the Depression through really rough times. You know, just had a horrible, horrible childhood. Suffered from what we now know would be PTSD. We didn't know that then, right? And no man that had been through combat in World War II would ever admit to having that anyway, right? My father was the guy that slept with a pillow, a loaded gun under his pillow, every day that he got home from combat. He was the guy that, and I'm a little girl, and he would chase people that disrespected him down on the freeway, and they'd have fist fights on the side of the road. He was the one that would lose his temper and just scream at me and tell me that I was worthless and nothing and ah. But he was also the one that stood in line for like 3 hours to get me a signed autograph, a signed picture, an autograph from Willie Mays. He was the guy that took me to, you know, to see President Lyndon Johnson when I was, again, in second grade. And he came through San Francisco. My dad came and picked me up and took me to San Francisco so that I could see a president, because he wanted his little girl to see a president. He was the guy that when I was in the hospital to have surgery, and I made a mild complaint, like everybody does, about the food. Yeah, the food's not so good here. He went home and he cooked a steak and covered it up and brought it to me. He was not a good father. He was big on grand gestures. When I got sober, my father was not real sure why. What the hell's the matter with you? What do you mean you're doing? What does that mean? I don't even understand what that means. When I got my 1 year chip, I took my chip to show my dad. Hey dad, look, I got a chip. 1 year sober. He goes, good for you, honey. Would you like a beer? I said, dad, no, I'm sober. I don't drink. He goes, even beer? God, what are you people, fanatics? Because I'm sorry, he's from Texas. Beer is not drinking. Everybody knows that. I will also tell you that when my father died, the night before my father died, the last thing I said to him was, hey, Dad, I'm not even home out of the office yet. I'll tell you what, instead of coming by tonight, because I'm not going to be back in Modesto until real late, how about I come by in the morning? He said, that'd be great, honey. I'll put the coffee on. We'll have coffee. I said, good. I'll see you in the morning, Dad. I love you. And he said, I love you too. And I was the one that found his body the next day. He had had a blood clot, and when he got up that morning to make coffee, it dislodged and it hit his heart and he died. And I was the only one of his three children that we know of that had a key to his house. And it was me who found his body. And it was me who got his mother-in-law back to Silver City, New Mexico. She was 96 years old, deaf and senile. I got her back there. It was me who took care of his estate. It was me that watched as my siblings went through all of his stuff and took all the stuff that had any value. I just stood there and let him do it. It didn't matter to me. And you guys were the ones that allowed that to happen. So you guys allowed me to be the child that had the key to his house, whose name was on his accounts, who was able to arrange for him to have a Catholic funeral. Because I was with my dad when he returned to the Catholic Church not 10 days before his death. And I have a theory, being a Catholic and being a trained Dominican theologian now, I have a theory that the reason my dad died 10 days after that is because God knew there was no way on God's green earth he was going to sustain that conversion. And he knew the first time he went to Mass and the priest said something he hated, he'd be barking right out of there again. And so, you know, he was like, "You're coming home now, buddy." And I'm the only one of his children that occasionally I can say, "I miss my dad." I do. A movie comes on TV that I knew he would like, and I think, "I gotta call Dad." Oh yeah. You guys did that for me. You gave that back to me. You know, my mother and I shared a home from the time that I got sober until she passed away. And at first it was because I couldn't afford to live anywhere else, okay? I was getting sober. I had this great job with Contra Costa County, and I was in debt up to my eyeballs, and I was going to declare bankruptcy. And my first sponsor, Kenny, when I brought it to him and said, "I think I should declare bankruptcy. I keep hearing everybody in the meetings of AA talk about declaring bankruptcy." And he said, "Oh, so you're a thief on top of everything else." And he was the one that made me, like, set up payment plans, and I had to, like, you know, pay back all of my creditors, and you know, when he took me through those first steps, that was what I did. And so by the time I was, like, debt-free and all this, it turned out that I really, really liked my mom, and the two of us were, like, best friends. And so when she said, "Leslie, I've decided I'm going to move from Pleasant Hill to Modesto to be near the grandkids," and so I was like, "Well, that's cool. You know, you can do that. I'm going to stay here in Pleasant Hill. You know, I'm going to probably find my own place. And God, that'll be great, Mom. I'll come and visit you at the holidays, you know, all this stuff." And she's, my little nephew, my little baby Ryan, looked at me. He was about 4 or 5, and he said, "But Auntie, if you don't come, what will I do?" So I moved to Modesto because that seemed to be a good idea. But I'm going to tell you how God works in my life. Because see, back in 1977, I was one of those people standing outside of Roman's Chinese Theater on a Thursday night at midnight, drunk off my butt and really high, big party. But there was a sneak preview of some brand new movie. So we all walked in there to see this movie, and it was Star Wars. And I fell in love with the Star Wars franchise. I just fell in love with those movies. I have Disney Plus only so I can see all the Star Wars stuff. Okay, I just love it. And my sobriety date, when I got sober, all it was the day after May 3rd. Well, today it's May 4th, which is celebrated as International Star Wars Day. But it gets better. Because at 5.5 years sober, I moved to Modesto, which is the hometown of George Lucas, who is the creator of Star Wars. Coincidence? I think not. You know, I told you I'm a trained Dominican theologian, and we have this guy that all of us love as Dominicans, is this saint called Thomas Aquinas. And Thomas came up with 5 proofs for the existence of God. And they were proofs where all you have to do is use your head. You don't use religion at all, right? You just use your intellect. And you can come up with proving intellectually that there is a God. I have a 6th proof, and I just described it to you. The fact that someone like me lives in George Lucas's hometown and my sobriety date is Star Wars Day. There you go. There's a God. And that God loves me. And I know that. But we moved there, and there were the two of us. We had this, you know, wonderful little home. And I started living in Modesto, and becoming a part of in Modesto. And I celebrate my 6th birthday in Modesto. And the majority of my sobriety, therefore, has been in the Central Valley of California. And I've made my friends there. My home group is there. It is the principal study group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet on Wednesday evenings at 5:45 at St. Joe's on Oakdale Road. We're also a hybrid meeting. If you're interested, I'd be happy to give you the Zoom information. We are a closed meeting of AA, and we're a 3 legacy group. We study the steps and the traditions out of the Big Book and the 12 and 12. And once a month, we do a concept presentation. And I love that group. And in 2020, when the world shut down, right? And everything went to hell, my group missed 1 week. And then boom, we were online. And we made the decision to put money into computer equipment so that we can now have people that come from all over California and outside of California to our meetings on Wednesday night. And that's because we want to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in 2020, you know, I know, 2020 was tough on everybody, right? It was particularly tough on me, just saying. You know, 2020 started off with my beloved San Francisco 49ers losing the Super Bowl because apparently NFL refs did not understand the meaning of offensive holding. No, I do not have any more resentments. I'm over it. But boy, did it look good to watch them lose on Thursday night, didn't it? Yeah. But no problem. I'm okay. I've gotten over it. And then the world shut down. And I had retired in 2017 from Contra Costa County after 30 years of service and had gone right to work with 3 days after retirement with St. Joseph's Catholic Church, where I was the coordinator of children's catechesis for 600 little children running around the campus. And I just loved it. It was like my dream job. And my mother at the time, she said, "Leslie, aren't you so thrilled about this? Because you always wanted to have children and you were always so sad you couldn't have any. And now you have 600. And you don't have to send any of them to college. Isn't that fabulous?" But suddenly everything shut down and I had to coordinate all this stuff online and I, you know, do like lessons for them on YouTube. And I mean, it was crazy, right? And then, pretty soon here comes May. And you know, my mother had always gone out and gotten me a birthday card for my sobriety birthday. And she couldn't go anywhere, right? I mean, she's 98 and a half years old. May is coming up. But she had one of my sobriety girls, one of my sponsees, smuggle in a birthday card. And I got up that morning on May 4th, and right there in front of the coffee pot was my birthday card. And when my mom came out of the room, I said, "Mama, thank you for doing this. I appreciate it so much." And my mother said to me, "Thank you for 28 years of peace." That was the best amends I could have ever made to her. I had made my direct amends to my mother. I had asked her, "Is there anything else I can do?" And my mother had said, stay in the middle, because she had heard you use that term, staying in the middle. And I did. And we had such a wonderful month. And then the Memorial weekend, we woke up that Sunday and we went to Mass online, and then we took flowers to the grave sites, and we came back and we watched a replay of the 49ers beating the Green Bay Packers with Terrell Owens making the catch too. It was so much fun, and we cheered like we had never seen the game before and we didn't know who was going to win, and we had so much fun. And I said to my mom, "I'm going to go in the back and go on a Zoom meeting." And she said, "Okay." I went into the back and I heard this horrible sound, and I came running out, and my mother had collapsed with a catastrophic stroke. And because of people in my faith tradition and because of Alcoholics Anonymous, they allowed me to bring my mother home from the hospital, and I was able to care for her for the last 3 days of her life. And AA showed up in a big way. You people came right in and you brought me coffee from Starbucks, and you sat with me and you prayed with me and you called me and you made sure I was okay. And the moment my mother took her last breath, 2 minutes after that, the doorbell rang and one of my grand sponsees was there with her whole family. And they walked in and they gathered around her and we prayed a prayer that's particular to my faith tradition. We prayed the rosary for my mother. You guys did that for me. But now suddenly I'm alone. But it's more than that. I'm not just alone. My mother had put me in charge of the family trust. I'm the sole trustee, and everybody else in the family are beneficiaries. And I'm going to tell you, it's been a very rocky, rocky 3 years. And I've had to make decisions about human beings that I love, But they are so out there about this. You'd think we were Rockefellers, for God's sakes. It's not that much money. People take a breath. You know what I mean? And yet I've had to make decisions that keeps them outside my immediate circle. And you know, on the way down here, I always pray when I'm about to share my story with people, because one of the things that I like to do when I'm asked to share my story is I like to bring people up to date with what's going on with me now. And I do that for one reason, because I have one prayer. And my prayer is that I hope that the one person here tonight that's supposed to hear me hears me. If more than one person does, that's great, but there's one person in here tonight that needs to hear this that I'm about to share. You know, I am a practicing Catholic and I'm lousy at it. I'm a member of a particular political party and I'm bad at that. I am a member of my neighborhood and a citizen of the world and a citizen, and I'm lousy at all of those things. In fact, there's really only one thing I've done 100% right for more than 3 decades. And that is, I have not had one drink of alcohol, I have not taken one illegal drug, and I have not used any legal drugs illegally. That is the only thing I have done right, 100% right, for over 3 decades. And what doing that has allowed me to do is to take this particular person that walked into the back doors of the Concord Fellowship, 300 pounds, sweating vodka, and broken, and to come to absolute terms with who and what she is. See, here's who I am. I'm the person that wakes up every morning going, maybe it's today. Maybe today that lotto numbers I bought will hit. Maybe today that diet I went on will work and I'll be perfect. Maybe today my brother will wake up and decide that he just loves me and he's not angry at me anymore. Maybe today I'll just be okay, just today. Maybe today Keanu Reeves will come to his senses. Maybe it'll be today. And I take that. See, because that's who I am. And every morning, I take that and I offer that to the God of my understanding. God, I offer myself to thee. Build with me. Do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of myself, the person who doesn't feel right, who doesn't feel adequate, who misses her family, who misses her mom, who wishes things were better all the time. Relieve me of the bondage of that so that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties. My victory over them may bear witness to those I could help of your power, your love, your way of life. May I do thy will always. My best friend in sobriety told me this week that she's moving to Las Vegas. I'm madder in hell. How dare she have a better life than me? I love this person so much, but how dare she? How dare she? Doesn't she know she's leaving me? My Creator, I ask that you take all of me, the good and the bad. Remove from me these defects of character standing in the way of my usefulness to you and to my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to better do your will. My checking account got hacked this week. I had to deal with all of that. My broker is retiring. I had to deal with all of that. And when that happens, and all I want to do is say, oh God, please, no more stuff. No more stuff. I just want to have a life that's just quiet and perfect. And I want my dog to win first place in the dog show, and I want the Niners to win the Super Bowl. Is that too much to ask God? You know, it's all I want. God, I offer myself to thee. Because, see, you have taught me that that's who I am. That's what I offer to God. And then I step back and I let God go to work. And he takes that sorry, selfish, what about me person and says, here's when you can do some good. Here, your phone's going to ring. Here, this person's going to invite you here. Here, this person's going to ask you for this. This sponsee needs this. You're asked to do here. Go. Do my will. Do my will. If you had told me that that's what my life would be when I got here, I wouldn't have stayed. But what I will tell you is this. Despite the fact that my life is not what I would like it to be, I can stand here and I can tell you that my life is second to none. I am so grateful that Nate invited me down here. I thank Lee for being my friend. I thank Cora for being such a great secretary, but most importantly, I thank all of you for my life. Thank you.
That was wonderful. Thank you so much.